Hey guys, and welcome to the 7th Underrated Minisode. I'm your host, Gabriel Green, and James, unfortunately, isn't able to be with us this week. His mic went out. So thankfully, I was able to get Gene Gosswer to come join me this time to talk about John Wick Chapter 2. But before we get into that, thanks for coming on, man.
Hey, I'm glad to be here. Thank you very much for asking me.
Hey, you're very welcome. You want to tell us a little bit about yourself before we move on?
Well, like you said, my name is Gene. The main place where folks can kind of find what I do online is through Real World Theology, and that's real with two E's. And on that website, realworldtheology.com, we do written reviews of movies. We cover a few TV shows. I'm currently right now getting back into The Walking Dead. And we have a podcast as well, and we look at movies from a Christian perspective primarily. We'll talk probably 50-50 about the quality of the film and that kind of stuff, and then we'll also get into some theology and stuff that every film might be touching on. So that's what I do online. I'm also involved with the Clear Lens podcast, and that's a Christian apologetics podcast. We are in a little bit of a break right now, but we'll be coming back, I think, in March. And we do one of those every couple weeks. So look for that to come back out. And other than that, find me on Twitter at Wizard of Gaz. And I am very much involved in the Real World Theology Facebook group. So that's a fun place to catch me.
Yeah, cool. I really like the Real World Theology podcast. I wasn't aware of the other one. I'll have to check that one out.
Yeah, we're about 2 years old now doing it. I think we got done 50 or so episodes, and particularly in 2016, we've gotten a lot of guests on. We got Greg Kokel on, we got Jay Warner Wallace on. We did a series of kind of examining different religions, and we had David Wood on to cover Islam. We've had Brian Godawa on a couple times, and we had him on to talk about Hacksaw Ridge very specifically. So that was a fun podcast to do. That's one that your listeners might be interested in checking out.
Did he like that one?
Yeah, he did. For the most part, it was a fun one to talk about because we all kind of had our own different areas where we didn't like it, and it was kind of fun to hear us kind of disagree about specific things. But we definitely got into the question of pacifism, which that movie definitely raises, whether mm-hmm. what was portrayed in the film is kind of an accurate portrayal of pacifism as the Bible might show it or might not show it. I thought we had a really good discussion on that one.
Should do a discussion of pacifism in John Wick. See how that turns out.
There we go. Flipping it here.
All right. Let's just dive right into it. John Wick 2, or Chapter 2, was directed by Chad Stileski. It's the closest I can get. The budget is currently unknown, and as of this recording, has grossed at least $40 million. It was written by Derek Kolstad. It stars Keanu Reeves, Ian McShane, Ricardo Scamarcio or something, Lawrence Fishburne, Common, Ruby Rose, Lance Reddick, John Leguizamo, and it was shot by Dan Lauston, and the score was composed by Tyler Bates. And I want to warn you guys, if you haven't seen the film, we will be spoiling it, so if you haven't seen it, go fix that and then come back and listen. All right, you're the guest, Gene, so I'll let you go first. What do you think about this movie?
I really liked it. I gave it 4 out of 5 stars in my Letterboxd review. If you're not on Letterboxd, by the way, you got to get on there. It's a great site to review movies and kind of converse with people of similar tastes or interests at the very least. But I really liked it. I thought, just in kind of a big picture view, the first movie had a surprising amount of depth, I thought, or at least a surprising amount of foundation to the reason for all the violence and all the killing. And this movie didn't really have that, but I thought it raised the bar in terms of the action and the stunt work. I thought it was really terrific. So while it was a little light on the depth, I thought it raised the bar on the action. And I think I gave the first one 4 stars as well. So in my view, this is a very, very solid sequel to John Wick.
So what was this depth in the first one?
Come on, man. He's fighting because his dog was killed, right? Which, that's shallow, right? If you're going to go kill some people because they killed your dog, then we're starting off the wrong foot. But it's about what the dog represents, Gabriel. The dog represents the life that he had with his wife, and now they killed his dog, and it's it's crashing everything down. So of course he has to murder everyone.
Oh, now it makes sense. Okay. yeah, and I also really enjoyed this film. I wasn't as in love with the first one as everybody else. I saw it like right alongside The Equalizer, the Anton Fuqua movie with Denzel Washington. They're both very similar. Have a retired operative engaging this one man war in this very heightened reality against the mob. That one actually, he's doing it for a good reason, to save a young prostitute who's being abused.
Mm-hmm.
And so kind of just comparing it, I like The Equalizer a lot more. So, but I definitely appreciate it for what it, appreciate this film for what it is. It reminds me a lot of like the Raid films.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Not Taiwanese. What are they? Indonesian? I think Indonesian martial arts films. And just where they have like a singular focus, they're going to give you action. And that's about all they do. And they do it really well. And this is the same thing with this. And the second one does what sequels should do. It makes it bigger. In an organic way, just expands the world. And that's one of the best things this film has, and the first film had going for them, aside from the awesome action and stunt work, which we'll get into later, is just the world this takes place in. The movie is like a live action cartoon. it feels like almost like an Assassin's Creed film. I was thinking, watching it this time, and especially the set piece in the middle, in Rome. It literally felt like Assassin's Creed 2, where just the settings and how you just have to sneak in, and then you have a conversation with the person before you murder them, and then you just and then you have to escape while all the guards are trying to kill you.
That's right.
And that's definitely not a bad thing.
No, it was it tried to kind of get a little poetic in parts there, I think, especially with the conversation before he murders the guy's sister. You felt kind of a history between the two, and mm-hmm. It was tragic in a sense that he didn't want to kill her, but he felt like he had to. Of course, he didn't actually have to. He could have just ran, or he could have just killed the guy holding his mark, who is the whole reason why he has to continue on this killing spree. He ends up needing to turn around and kill him anyways, so he could have just done that right at the very beginning. But it does get in the middle there, where they're in Rome. It does get a little bit poetic in nature, in that the way that the life was taken of the sister was contrary to everything else in the movie, right? Every other death in that movie occurs very quickly, very violently, very abruptly, but her death is very slow. It is it's in her own control to a certain degree, because she decides how she actually dies. She slits her wrist. So it's in that moment, it slows down a lot. So you just kind of have this idea that you need to be paying more attention to the dialogue than you necessarily would be for the rest of the film. So it has that kind of contrast there with that. And I thought that was really good. And then I think too, it had a lot of flashbacks, to John's former life with his wife. And if you've seen the first one, we got more in the first one about some details of that life and what happened, why his wife is gone. Some of those things in the second one bothered me a little bit, because it felt like it was relying too much on the viewer not knowing or not having seen the first one. And I usually don't like when sequels do that. You may feel differently, but I usually don't like when sequels just kind of intentionally sort of pause and take moments to just be like, hey, remember this thing from the first movie and how you really liked it, and just sort of hit the brakes on what they're currently doing just to make that callback. What did you think of that?
Yeah, I did notice the scenes where it's like, yeah, just in case you missed it, this is what happened.
Yeah.
But I did find them, I mean, every sequel has that. Some work it in better than others. Usually, especially if the first film didn't really call for a sequel, you kind of have to with the second one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's understandable. I thought it was pretty sparse. But one, I think the awesome way they integrated that in was in the opening sequence, which is, it's probably my favorite scene in the film, where you have John Wick. He's going to get, he finished the last film. He got his dog. He killed the guy who killed his dog, and now he's going to get his car.
And, it's funny because I had forgotten all about the car until it started off that way in this one.
Yeah, and so you have Peter Stormare as the mob boss who has his car, and he's like monologuing to his subordinate about just how awesome and badass John Wick is. He's like, with a pencil.
Yeah.
Who does that?
Yeah.
And it's like interspliced as John Wick's infiltrating. And in the other film, you would have just been rolling your eyes, but this film is just so gleefully in love with its world and with its characters that it's actually quite funny. Throughout the fight, you just keep cutting back to hit close-ups of his face, and his eyes are like looking around trying to figure out when this guy's going to finally come in. And it's just a brilliant sequence. And I like how they vary the action. Like, there's actually in the first sequence, there's very little gunplay. It's mostly like this incredible car fighting. I don't know how you explain it, but it's pretty amazing. Like, forget Fast and Furious. Or get this guy to direct the next Fast and Furious film.
Yeah, that's a good point. The absence of the gunplay, for a moment it occurred to me, like, why don't all these mob guys have guns that they're pulling on him? Because they just run at him and fight him. Yeah, it would be. But they just run at him to fight him, and nobody pulls out a gun to shoot him, which is a little strange. But because what you mentioned with them flashing back to the mob boss and his face and his reactions and how he's thinking about how dangerous John Wick is, it gives you that sense that the film knows what it is. It's not trying to be serious. Like you mentioned, The Equalizer, that's a serious message kind of action movie. That's not what this is. John Wick knows that it is a little silly. It knows that it can kind of ham it up a little bit in moments like that. I think too about the subtitles. They bothered me at the start a little bit, but then it eventually grew on me how you'd have the subtitles across the screen whenever the characters were speaking a different language, and you'd have the first few words in just normal kind of italicized font, white font, and then you'd have like one word like in red blood-soaked letters, like real slowly fading across the screen, and it was
usually
just
Wick.
Yes, or what was he called? Not the ghost, but the bloodhound or something like that.
Boogeyman.
The boogeyman, yes, the boogeyman, and the that word.
The kid of the boogeyman.
And that word would just be real slowly, gradually shown across the screen, and it was like, yeah, that's a little silly, but I get it. I know what this movie is. It's just embellishing all these kinds of silly things, but it's a lot of fun still.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's one thing I noticed about this film. It had a lot more of a sense of humor about than the first one did. First one was fairly grim, but this one, it has a lot of the kills are played for laughs, and it's a little disturbing, but it's just there is a really subtle sense of humor just woven throughout, especially in the action scenes.
Yeah,
it's slightly disturbing, but it's still funny. And then just the whole world that was created in the first one with these just tantalizing glimpses with the Continental and the gold coins and the cleaning service and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But this one dives even deeper into it to the point where I think this film might take place in like an alternate reality or something, because there are no cops. There's only one cop in both films, despite the fact of gunfights and murders happening in the open everywhere. And the one cop we have is in on the whole thing. And then another thing I noticed in this film is that there is absolutely no collateral damage, despite the fact of hundreds of rounds being fired in thick crowds. No one ever gets shot. And that was probably an intentional choice just to not go there.
Yeah.
But it just increases the whole otherness of the society that exists. I love the scene where you have the Cassian, the assassin played by Common, and John Wick walking parallel to each other. One's on the second floor, he's on the bottom floor. Just having this nonchalant battle with silenced pistols in the middle of a crowd and no one notices.
Yep, no one gets hit, no one notices. And either before or after that, they do a similar thing where they're on opposite sides of a water fountain, and the fountain goes up and they start shooting each other, and they miss, obviously, neither of them die from that, but there's crowds of people around them. Like, you know someone else got hit, but we never see it.
Yeah, no. It's the sequence in New York after the $7 million reward has gone out, and where he's like slowly getting beaten down, worn down by more and more assassins. It reminded me a lot of a Liam Neeson film called Run All Night, which also starred Common as an assassin hunting Liam Neeson
Oh, really?
as they were running through New York trying to survive.
I'll have to
It was
check that
kind of,
out.
yeah, it was kind of a funny parallel.
I thought Common was a really good addition to this. I feel like he matched Keanu Reeves stare for stare almost.
Lots
And
of good stairs.
yeah, and this is kind of what Keanu does in this type of role. He has these very distinguishing facial features, especially when he has his beard, that just are automatically intimidating. And with Common, he has the shaved head. He has I may be getting this wrong, but I think no facial hair at all.
Think he had
But
a goatee.
okay, there you go. But his eyes are just so piercing into whoever he's looking at that you know when they're staring each other down, they are ready to kill in a moment's notice. And I thought Common, I thought he really matched him beat for beat in this movie. He did a great job.
Yeah, he definitely brings a great presence. And Keanu Reeves is such an interesting actor. I still don't know if he can act, but he brings an incredible presence it to his roles like Neo or especially this one, where I mean he's just so freaking intimidating. And the guy's like 52, but he could still be a model. No one looks better in a suit than this guy.
Well, being 52, I'm pretty sure he did like 95% of his stunts in this movie.
Yeah.
I was thoroughly impressed by all the fighting, all the judo throws that he was doing. That was very impressive. Obviously, he wasn't driving the car and stuff when it was doing all of its tricks. But boy,
I wouldn't be surprised if he was. Tom Cruise drives his own stunt cars.
yeah, you could be right. You could be right. I mean, if nothing else, he was still doing all that fighting. I mean, it was obvious. Even some of the parts where he was falling downstairs,
Oh my gosh.
it seemed like him. I feel like I'm pretty sure that was a stunt double. I don't know if you'd ask Keanu Reeves to fall downstairs for you, no matter how short they are. But
Those weren't short.
no,
That was a painful scene, man.
he was doing a lot of his own work in this, and bravo for him, man. He did a great job.
So what do you think about this whole like expanded mythology they went into with this film, where now you don't not just Ian McShane, but now you have another Continental, and then the phone service and all that crazy stuff. It was just so much fun to just delve into it.
Yeah, it was. It was very interesting. You kind of got a glimpse or a hint of it in the first one. I think there was always this sense that this was bigger than just John Wick. We learn, I think, from the second or third scene when D'Antonio, I think it is, who has his mark, comes to him to recall the mark against him, and basically kind of says how he helped him do the impossible task that gained him his freedom in the first movie. And so now you're thinking back of the reputation of John Wick, how he became who he is, and now all of a sudden we learn that, okay, maybe he had some help, maybe this guy contributed a little bit to his reputation as the boogeyman. And that expands that bit a little bit, but then this guy, D'Antonio, is talking about how there's this council that he wants to be on, and his sister is on it now, and he wants to be a voice on that council. So now that expands it even further, and then he travels to Rome to that other continental, and it's another place where you can't do anything there, no killing, no fighting, nothing. And it's incredible how strict that these murderers are to rules like that, where
Whoever said there's no honor amongst thieves.
yeah, that's I was thinking that at various points throughout the movie. When he and Common are having their fight and they crash through the window of the Continental and they fall on the ground, both with guns to each other's heads, and the owner of the Continental basically says, "Nope, not in here." And they both stop. They both stop and go to the bar and have a drink and just talk to each other. There's still a lot of tenseness there, of course, but almost as though they hadn't even just been trying to kill each other. And it's funny how they can have that sort of control over when and where they can do these type of things, but then just be ruthless killers in all other circumstances. I think it says a lot about turning that kind of stuff off and on, and whether that's like anywhere near any kind of reality that we might expect, or if that's that's just even more of this otherworldliness that we have already built into all of the kind of the showiness and the hamminess that we have already in the previous scenes.
Yeah, there's a real sense of history, like as if this has been going on for decades and will continue to go on after the movie's over. And that just helps us buy into the whole believability of this absurd film. And we obviously haven't talked about it yet, but man, the action in this film is, there are really no words just to describe how incredibly proficient these directors, Chad Stahelski, he was a former stuntman, so, and you can just see that on screen, just wide, long takes with crazy choreography going on in every single take, and you can tell it's the real actor in there. And it's just, it's like a ballet, watching this just ballet of violence and headshots, and you just can't stop watching.
Yeah, I agree. One thing I think people think a lot about now when they think of action films is almost always the shaky camera. And I think that's to the discredit of a lot of action films. I think the shaky camera is fine when used in moderation, but when used too heavily, like with the last couple of John Bourne movies or Jason Bourne movies, I think it becomes a distraction and almost like a headache inducing thing aspect of the film. And with John Wick, and I think it did the director did this successfully in both films. And you mentioned it, just having a wide shot and being able to see more of the surroundings rather than a tight focused in shot of the fight itself with the camera shaking around so much. And that wide shot gives us a sense for what's coming in, what all of the choreography that had to take place for these punches and these kicks to be timed out so well, so that we can see them in a kind of a still camera and it be believable rather than having to rely on a camera shaking around just to give us a sense of how hectic this all of this is. And I think it really succeeded in selling those fight scenes because it just focused on them and it didn't try to use any kind of tricks to show you how major they were or anything.
Yeah, there is a reason people do the shaky cam and quick cuts, because the danger in long wide takes is that any lag or just slow pace within the fight, you feel it. Mm-hmm. If it's not perfectly timed, you notice, oh, this looks really fake. And see, you have to put a lot of time and planning and prep into these fights. And like Keanu Reeves, you watch him with the gun in the range, he's as good as John Wick just about.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult to do. And I'm really glad the film took the time to give us this action. And I love how the action is varied. As we talked about, it opens up almost no gunplay, just crazy cars and lots of judo and jiu-jitsu stuff. And then we get this mesmerizing scene with the concert where he assassinates the guy's sister, with just like the overpowering music and the colors and all that stuff just build this incredible scene. And then the fights go into the tunnels, and where you get the introduction of AR-15 and shotguns and all that stuff. And then we get that wonderful like scrappy sequence in New York streets as it's getting more and more hurt with all these different weird assassins. And then we get to see the pencil trick, That was pretty brutal.
Yeah.
and then it ends in the really awesome mirror sequence. So they succeed in keeping the fight scenes just varied with different locations and styles throughout. to keep it from getting too boring.
Yeah, I would agree. They use all different kinds of tools as well. Not only do they use handguns, but like you mentioned, they use shotguns, assault rifles. They use knives, various assortment of knives to do their fighting with, and pencils, anything handy. Let me ask you, do you think, because in the first movie, there was, I didn't feel like anyways, there was any indication that there would be a sequel. I think most of the talk or the buzz that there would be a sequel came after the movie was released and it was getting such rave reviews. It was so well received by a lot of people. In this film, it's very clear they're going to go for a third movie. He's mm-hmm. The hit on him has gone from a national hit to an international hit, and however much money is on his head now. So we're going to see him fight even more and more assassins. Do you like that choice of purposefully pointing towards a third film, or would you rather it be more of a kind of a what if sort of thing?
I love the ending, just the crazy panic and paranoia as he's running away and all the guys are looking at him. So I think it's a perfect ending, whether or not we get sequels. My only worry with the sequel would be just how many ways can you make headshots interesting after a while? Because like even in the first film, there were moments where it get a little monotonous, where the action just keeps going and going. I felt a little bit of that in this film. And if they're going to very rigidly adhere to a zero character development and zero thematic depth policy, I don't know how far you can stretch it.
Yeah, I mean, I felt like there was depth in the first one and very much less so in this one. And there's really, I mean, God, it just goes to say about a character arc in that I'm only just now thinking about whether there was a character arc. That really didn't occur to me to even look for it too much. So if it's decreased that much from the first to the second movie, I hope it doesn't make that same leap downwards for a third movie. I'd like to think they could bring something else in, but you almost wonder, are they still going to rely on his ties to his wife and that the good life, so to speak, and continue to kind of play on that as being his motivation for wanting to live, or are they going to bring something else in? That's an interesting thing to ponder.
Yeah, I'm sure they could find something. I mean, go to a different country and show us the criminal underground there or something.
Yeah.
My one last big positive was I love how they hire just these awesome character actors to have these tiny bit parts around the film, just because it makes the world that much colorful when they highlight. Basically, every character we meet is given this awesome highlight, and every character actor is just having so much fun hamming it up. We have Peter Stormare in the beginning, and our Common as the assassin, and Lawrence Fishburne shows up as this homeless, or the king of the homeless, and John Leguizamo is the dealer, and this other guy from Guardians of the Galaxy, I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce his last name, as the weapons dealer. I love that scene.
That is a neat scene.
The world is so rich, both in lore and just the characters we meet.
You mentioned Lawrence Fishburne. Let me talk about him for a minute. When he came on screen, so first and foremost, he's, like you said, I think he's called the Bowery King. That's like his official title, but he's basically in charge of the panhandlers in the city. So, you know, it turns out that all these people asking for money are actually assassins themselves, and they take all the money they receive back to the Bowery King, and they have this whole network set up. So he's got his tentacles all throughout the city. When John Wick met him, I think anyone watching this who has seen The Matrix had to have been waiting for some sort of line that calls back to The Matrix, because this is exactly the type of movie that would do that. And I don't know if I just missed it or if I'm not as versed in The Matrix as I thought I was or what, but I didn't catch anything in there like, you know, make a choice for the red or the blue or anything like that, or you're the one.
Guns.
Yes. I know Kung Fu. Nothing like that. And I was really hoping that it would, as cheesy as I know it would be, and as much as it could have definitely gotten raked over the coals by critics, I thought it would have fit perfectly into this movie. I was kind of bummed that I didn't get any of that. But it was nice to see Fishburne and Reeves on the screen again together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So do you have any other positives you want to mention before we move into things we might have not liked about this film?
Nope. I think I'm covered.
All right, I guess I'll start with that. It's basically my same problem with the first film, although at least we had a dead dog to distract us in that one. And this essentially, these films are Keanu Reeves walking around and shooting a lot of people. He probably kills at least 100 people in this film.
That's just in the tunnels.
The most selfish of reasons. It's just at a point, the film comes to a point where I'm like, if I think about what is happening, I'm going to hate it. So I have to basically just turn my brain off and enjoy it.
Oh, yeah.
Because what is happening on screen is just so deeply morally reprehensible. I mean, he literally goes and murders a friend to save his own life. It's like, shouldn't it be the other way around or something? It's like there's no concept of morality anywhere in this film.
Well, listen, I mean, they don't hurt each other inside the Continental. That's some semblance of morality, I guess.
it's the rules.
But then he does actually kill D'Antonio at the end. Mm-hmm. Then that huge hit is put on him. So, yeah, this is I totally get that complaint. And I recognize that that's morally reprehensible. It's not anything that we would champion in the real world or anything, but I want to be on John Wick's side. I mean, they killed his dog, Gabriel, his dog. He had to go get another dog that he didn't even name. He just calls him dog. How sad is that? I mean, this is what I mean by the depth decreasing in this one, in my view, because in the first one, that dog that was killed represented the relationship, the only thing left that he had from his wife, who died a terrible death from cancer or something, I think is what their reference was to. But that was the only thing he had left, was the dog. And then this second movie, when it starts with him getting the car back, well, the car isn't necessarily connected, I don't believe, to his wife in the way that the dog is, at the very least.
He had to get that envelope.
Just so happened to have an envelope in there that he couldn't just steal out of the car instead of driving the car away. He had to drive the car away and kill everybody and then get the envelope out. So yeah, that's very crucial, having a little note. So that's the kind of the superficial face of this, I think, as compared to the first one. I mean, they killed his dog. That's all I'll say.
I guess growing up around a lot of dogs, that doesn't seem as egregious as maybe it would have.
You heard it here, folks. Dogs are disposable. Dogs are disposable. Gabriel said it.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I don't approve of robbing vets, but wouldn't that have been a lot more socially responsible? Just kind of begin with stealing from the vet instead of killing the 74 guys. And then going to get a new dog. It's just...
Maybe.
I don't know. Yeah, and I think there comes a point in the film where, in spite of the beautiful choreography, the cinematography, the colors, everything is like technically perfect, there comes a point where it's like, especially towards the end when he's going through the museum, where it just almost becomes just tedious after the 75th headshot.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah, he's awesome. He kills a lot of people. It just that's where you feel the weight of all these deaths stacking up.
Right. Right.
Yeah, I think if as awesome as the action sequences are, if they had trimmed it down a bit more, they would have kept their impact and their awesome factor. To where, as good as it is, it becomes overkill, no pun intended, towards the end.
Yeah. Yeah, you may have a point there. It's kind of like the saying, too much of a good thing is a bad thing. You know, we can see him make all of these impressive kills and takedowns and whatever, but if we just see the same thing over and over and over again, it's kind of like it's losing its value or its meaning or from a film perspective. So yeah, I can definitely see that complaint.
Did you have any dislikes you wanted to mention?
The connection to the first movie, and I mentioned this a little bit. This is just kind of, I think, a personal hang-up of mine. I just feel like if you're going to see a sequel, you should have already seen the first one. So why does the sequel need to take such great efforts to recall specific things in the first one? That should already be built into the memory of the audience so that they know when certain things happen, it's because of this that happened before. Maybe that's probably just my own hang up. I recognize that there are going to be people in the theater that probably haven't seen the first one, and they're going to want to know why it is that he's even stealing this car. What's this connected to? And that's basically the whole first scene, just describing why it is he's there to steal this car. So that was a bit of a hang up for me, but it's okay. That's easily forgivable.
Yeah, but when you're getting guys like Ian McShane and Peter Stormare to give the exposition, it's yep. a lot more entertaining.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Yeah, I definitely get irritated when critics use the fact that it's a continuing story to bash it for not bringing you up to date. But I'm also sympathetic to a filmmaker who realizes, yeah, even those who saw it last time, it's been 2 years ago.
Sure.
You might want to bring them up to date. I understand both sides. I guess my last thing is both a positive and a criticism is that this film is very well structured and it very well paced. It moves very well, just from the opening to he gets home, he buries all his stuff and immediately there's a knock on the door. Just everything leads very well. Every sequence leads into the next sequence, the next scene, to the next character, except for one part, which is actually the Lawrence Fishburne part with the Bowery King.
Oh, you didn't like that one?
No, I love Lawrence Fishburne. He's having a blast as the character, but you could literally, it's essentially the scene where Keanu Reeves regroups and then before heading into the climax.
Right.
And that the function that the Bowery King serves could have been accomplished by basically anybody. And the amount of time they spend on it feels kind of self-indulgent. It's the only time in the film, other than some of the extended fight sequences where I got a little bored. It's mm-hmm. just because it is all style over substance, and the style is great, but if it doesn't have much of a story purpose, just to wander, like you could have shown the Bowery King's kingdom in like a two minutes, but we spent about 15 minutes there. It just feels a little tedious. Not a huge problem,
yeah.
But it's just in such an economical film, you definitely notice it.
Yeah, I guess what I would look for, and what I was surprised didn't happen in the film, is for that to come back around and be a significant part of the conclusion in this film. So maybe in the third one, that's going to really impact. And maybe, who knows, maybe the Bower King has panhandlers all across the globe. Because we saw a lot of them receiving the same text message that, you know, in 1 hour, John Wick has this price on his head. So, it wouldn't be surprised at all if that came back around and we had kind of a Lawrence Fishburne bit of a showdown with Keanu Reeves again. I enjoyed that. I appreciated the time away. You're definitely right. It was a bit of a slowdown of the pace or a regrouping before he got to that climax. I like that part. The one part I thought was built up to such a degree that the conclusion of it was a letdown was D'Antonio's right hand girl, the one who couldn't talk, or mm-hmm. she was mute or something. She never said a word. She just used sign language. And there was the implication the whole time that she was some sort of a stud fighter. Like she mm-hmm. was it, you know, every other one of these henchmen was going in before her because she was kind of the lead assassin of D'Antonio's squad. And when it came down to the fight between John Wick and her, it felt really lopsided and over very quickly. I mean, the fight between John Wick and Common's character was far better. And I was just really let down by that fight between D'Antonio's right-hand woman and John Wick. I felt it was For as much as it was played up throughout the film that we would see it, I was really let down when it finally came.
I wonder if that was the director poking fun at the idea that a 100-pound woman can beat up a whole bunch of henchmen, as they show in so many films, like Black Widow and whatnot. And I guess they were probably going for realism, because Ruby Rose is a fairly petite woman, and Keanu Reeves is not a small guy.
Right.
So in reality, if they actually did grapple, it would be over fairly quickly. And I'm guessing that's what they were going for.
Right. Well, then it would have to get to a point of grappling then, but I mean, she had her knives and she could, I don't know, rely on her quickness. I don't know. I just feel like that could have been a much cooler fight than it was, and I was really disappointed by it.
Yeah, it was short. All right. So is there anything else you want to mention before we start wrapping up?
I think that about covers it.
All right. So I guess you definitely recommend this film to people.
I do. You got to know that it's the type of film for you. I mean, there's a ton of bloodshed. There's headshots left and right. There's decapitations, I think. So there's all manner of violence in this. So you got to know that you're okay with that kind of movie. But it is a lot of fun. Don't go into it expecting something like The Equalizer. But go into it ready to be kind of entertained and ready for the movie to know what it is and to be giving you a lot of the things that you're sort of looking for in just a fun shoot 'em up action flick.
Yeah. This film is the definition of style over substance, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I had a huge blast. I love watching and analyzing the action scenes, so I love the action scenes. I ultimately do take some notches off my rating just because there is no depth, there is no character development and all that. But still, anyone who likes action films should watch this movie.
Oh, yeah.
And all Hollywood directors need to watch this movie to learn how to shoot action scenes.
Definitely.
Yeah, so it's a total blast, and even though they don't even try to do any kind of depth, they go above and beyond in the world building, creating this fascinating little world that I definitely want to see more of. So I'm not going to be mad if they make a sequel to this, even though there's absolutely no reason to.
Yeah,
why not?
Not much else to do, but more of the same. But you know what? If that's all it is, I'll still go see it.
All right. Well, thanks, man, for coming on. It was a very last-minute notice, but I really appreciate it.
I was glad to be able to talk about this and kind of dive into some things we liked and didn't like, and I really appreciate you having me on.
All right. I want to give you one last chance to plug anything you have online so people can find you.
Once again, I'm on with realworldtheology.com. Actually, just earlier tonight, we recorded our 2016 year in review, and we also looked at some Oscar films by category and kind of picked some of the ones that we liked best. So yeah, check that out, realworldtheology.com. Subscribe to that podcast, and also clearlens.org. That's a blog and podcast. Yeah, just those two things.
All right. And I'd like to ask you guys, if you enjoy this podcast, to please take a moment to subscribe and rate and review us on iTunes. Doesn't have to be a lot, just 5 stars and a few words. We would really appreciate it. And also, if you want to follow us, you can like us on Facebook. We are there as Underrated Podcast. Or you can follow us on Twitter as Underrated_pod. And if you'd like to find the older episodes, you can go to our website, underratedpodcast.com. And next episode will be on The Book of Eli, starring Denzel Washington. All right, thanks for listening to our review of John Wick Chapter 2, and we will see you next time.